Let's get to the book, though. We're studying the book of Ruth, and it's chopped up because of the things that intervene. We've had all sorts of interruptions, and so I want us tonight or today to study the book of Ruth and to get a concept of what the book of Ruth is. If you look at the outline of the book of Ruth, and that's what we're presenting, and that'll be that next slide. If you look at the outline of the book of Ruth, go ahead and change slides. There we go. There's the outline of the book of Ruth. There it is right there. If you look and study that, I've divided it up into these sections because I took chapter 1 and made 3 sections out of it because there are 3 distinct parts of that. And so this is the outline of the book of Ruth. You read about the move from Bethlehem to Moab, from Moab back to Bethlehem, and then finally back to Bethlehem when they move into Bethlehem. That's chapter 1. There are 22 verses involved in that, and we're not going to look at those. We're going to come back and look at these verses in a minute. Just want you to get an overview of the book. When you get to chapter 2, the time whenever Boaz is introduced in this. Now Ruth is back in Judah. She's in the promised land, and now Boaz comes into the scene, and that's in chapter 2. And all of chapter 2 concerns her harvesting the barley grain and her dealing with Boaz. Chapter 3, and that's what's on the outline, it's in the threshing floor itself. And that is that incident whenever she introduces to Boaz and talks to him about the responsibility under Judaism. It's rather remarkable that Ruth is sort of the one that brings this up because she's not even a Jew. And so we'll get to that whenever we get over there. And then we'll talk about when she marries him. That's in the early part of chapter 4. And then finally, it's just the genealogy from Ruth down to David. That's sort of the outline of the book. Not hard. Easiest reading book in the Bible. I really believe it's the easiest book in the Bible. Now, let's talk geographically, and then we'll get back to looking at the text. If you look on the screen, there's a map that will show the geography. And so if you look on the screen, do you see where Bethlehem is? You understand that's just outside of Jerusalem. You know where Bethlehem is. And then you look over in the map side and you see written horizontally the word Moab. And that's where Naomi moves, Elimelech moves Naomi and his 2 sons over to Moab. And we'll come back to this in just a minute, but we've already discussed this in quite a bit of detail in a previous class, so we're not going to spend a lot of time looking at that. And if you look over to the events that transpire to sort of get an overview of this, but the really real purpose I want you to do as you look at this is get a map. Now, where on earth do the Moabites come from? Where do they originate in Bible history? Well, if you'll remember the story of Abraham and Lot and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the Moabite nations are the grandsons of Lot. That's who they are. And so in that sense, they're cousins of the Jews. Now, they're about first cousin 6 removed or 5 removed. I'm not sure how you figure all of that. But over on the right side, I've just put the historical events. And we've already discussed some of these, but this is really just a matter of review because we've not had, nor will have 8 or 9 classes in each semester, as we call them here. And we don't really have that time in this study. We've got 4 chapters to cover, and it's been chopped up and moved around a bit. But you already know this. You remember, do you not, about the famine that there was? And so let's get back as you've got. Well, let's look at the things that are listed there on the right side of the screen. Go back to the map for just 1 minute. If you look there on the right side of the screen, you'll be able to see she's married to Elimelech, and this is focusing on Naomi. the two sons she has, the move to Moab, the sons marry, and then all three men die. And that's about where we were in the study of the book. And then Naomi and Ruth return back to the promised land. And then we spent an entire class, I believe it was the last study that we had together, about God cares for Ruth, God cares for Naomi, and God cares for widows. And so we really chased a rabbit out over here and looked at all those verses in the Bible, because there are 30 plus widows in this church, and there are some more women of this church who will be widows, and you need to understand the special place you have in God's heart. And I would just encourage every person, every widow, she make that study. And once you made it, don't just make it and then forget about it for the next 7 or 8 years. I would sit down and read those verses often. You need to understand that the Bible places widows so high on God's remarkable orders of priorities. Pure and undefiled religion is what? It's not doctrinal soundness, and that's sometimes the emphasis, and I'm not minimizing that at all, but listen to this description. Pure and undefiled religion is to visit the fatherless and widows in their afflictions. And, you know, we have 4 or 5 widowers in this church, and so God doesn't say much about you except by the implication that you are like a widow. You are a male leader. How's that for a transgender situation? You are a male widow, you understand? And so the implication is God's going to take care of you. But the emphasis in the Bible is of these helpless women. You think about the economy of that first century world, if it's agriculture, and the worker in that family dies. Think about the inability of that widow even to survive, even to retain her property. And then you think about the widow's son of Nain. She had a son. What happened? He dies. Guess what? Jesus takes care of her. And that's, if you'll study every verse in the Bible about widows, you will be astounded that almost without a single exception, every time they're mentioned, there's the mention of God taking care of them. And so we need to bear that in mind. And then we will talk about, and this is where we're headed in the lesson today, Ruth and her devotion to God's law. And we'll come back to that. That doesn't mean much to you. That's where we're. But now let's get back. Let's go to that next slide and go to where we are. And this is the talking about they move from Bethlehem to Moab because there's a man by the name of Elimelech. And he and Naomi and their sons go to Moab because of a famine. There's time to look at, because verse 1 of chapter 1 says that Ruth lived during the time of the judges. And so if you'll study the Old Testament, you'll come to recognize that God dealt with Israel physically. And we'll come back to that a little bit later when we talk about judges. In this lesson, hopefully we'll get to it. And whenever that judge was alive, they were faithful to God. But whenever that judge died, they disobeyed God, and God brought physical judgments against them. And so it may be, I want you to hear that, not it was, but it may be that's the reason that famine was there. And so Elimelech takes Naomi, his wife, and his two sons, and they go to Moab. And when they get there, in the order in which it's stated in the text, Elimelech dies. Now we got Naomi and her two sons. And so the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, marry women who are Moabites. And so then these boys die. Now I want you to become Naomi. How much more wretched could your life become? In fact, a little bit later in this chapter, if you will look in this chapter down in the closing verses of this chapter, she says, "Don't call me Naomi." You know what Naomi means? Pleasant. Call me Mara, because God has brought bitterness into my life. I don't believe that's an accusation against God. You read it and you can read it in that way, But it's just an affirmation that, God has allowed these things to happen. And so her life at this point has zero joy. How would you like to lose a husband? You might want to lose your husband. How would you like to lose your husband and your two sons? You don't get to pick and choose which one. How would you like to lose your husband and your two sons in a very, very short period of time? I believe the period of time, if I'm right, is 7 years. I believe the expression 7 years is found. How's that for your life tumbling, coming to an end? And so, the three widows head back to the promised land. And so let me get my text open. We'll be looking at the text and discussing it together and looking at some specific verses as we look at these matters. Man, Ruth is such a two-page book in my Bible. You know, you get two pages stuck together, cannot even find it. And so Naomi is ready to leave. And look down at verse 6. Then she arose with her daughter-in-laws that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. Famine's over. Let's go back home. Now, if you've ever found yourself isolated in strange environment, emotionally you understand what's happening. If you're if you moved to a foreign country and your husband and your children had died, you are a foreigner in Moab. Folks in Bethlehem know her, and as we shall notice, when she got back to Bethlehem, they were so glad to see her. Naomi's back, which says something about her character. You ever have anybody move out of your neighborhood and you hope they never moved back? You ever had those kinds of neighbors that they moved away and you thought, what I'm going to do without these neighbors? And so when Naomi comes back, they were really glad to have her. And can you imagine, with all of the grief that she had, the joy that she had as she went? Therefore, verse 7 says, as she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughter-in-laws with her, and they went on their way, and look at this, to return to the land of Judah. I want you to think what that says. Read it slowly. It was not just that Naomi wanted to go. Who wanted to go? All of them. They all wanted to go. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back home. Go back home. Please go back home. That's in verse 8. The Lord has dealt kindly with you as you have dealt kindly with me, with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest in the house of her husband. You're going to go back, find your husband. And she says, now wait a minute. I know my culture is that when a woman dies, a woman's husband dies, her brother is to marry her. Now then, what do you do when there are only two brothers? And so Naomi says, you know how old I am? Are you going to hang around until I have some other children so they can fulfill God's law about the brothers marrying? And so she urges them, and he says, go back and to find your husband. So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. Guys, we read it too carefully. We've got to slow down. We've got to slow down and read it and feel the emotion. You know what an emotional time this is? Never going to see each other again. Last time we're ever going to see each other is right here at this place and this time. And they said, oh no, surely we will return with you to your people. Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, you know, of having a husband and having other children, I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons. Would you wait for them? Are you going to wait for these sons to reach whatever the age of marriage is in that culture? You're just going to hang around. And so Naomi says, there are only two people I know real well and that I really love, and I'm about to kiss them goodbye, but you go back. What does that tell you about the character of Naomi? You're talking about a sort of an unsung hero in the Bible. I think it gets even better. But she says, turn back and go their way. Turn back, my daughters. You see that in verse 11 and verse 12? Turn back. And then he says in the middle of verse 13 to them, no, my daughters, it grieves me very much for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. If you felt the emotion in the first verse, feel the emotion now. They wept again. Then they lifted up their voices and wept. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. You got a picture? I don't know if while they were hugging each other and crying, she ever turned her loose. And what'd she say? When you get to this point, I want you to pay attention to Ruth's words. They lifted up their voices and wept. And she said, Naomi says, Ruth, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. I want you to hear that. She's gone back to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law, but Ruth said. Ruth says, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. I want you to see the distinction. Go back to your gods. And Ruth said, not on your life. Naomi, you've had such an impact on me. I want your God. Special word to all of the women, but it's equally applicable to all the men in this audience. How does your family, not your immediate family, how would they look at your God in view of you? How do your neighbors look at your God in view of you? I don't know, it's probably been a long time since in a marriage ceremony people have requested me to read this verse and to apply it to a wife talking to her husband. I think part of the reason is our culture has changed. There was a time when a person married, they wanted to become one flesh. But it's my car, talk to the husband, your car. My banking account, your banking account. And sometimes it's my children. You understand that? And so here in a marriage, and how fitting these words are, I'll go wherever you go. I want to be beside you. May I illustrate, and not in a braggadocious way, but in a heart filled with thanksgiving, of a daughter who sits beside her husband who followed him for 18 years to Kenya. Wherever you go, I'll go. And to a wife of 64 years who has followed me all around the world, never questioning. Wherever you go, I'll go. Now, you need to apply that to husbands to have that same kind of love. But I find this particularly amazing. It is daughter-in-law talking to a mother-in-law. Your people shall be my people. Husbands, you got a brand new family. You now have two mamas. You've got the one that you despise all your life that you've always had her. You can't really get rid of her, but you're marrying that woman. And you need to live in front of that second woman in such a way, he's my son. Your people shall be my people. Wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. And wherever you die, I will die, and that's where I'll be buried. No wonder this verse has been used lots of times in weddings in the past. Because if there's any verse that has application to marriage, it's this verse. It's oneness. I mean, you're talking about, I am going to give up every god that I have, and I'm going to, your God will be my God. And when you've got a husband and a wife who both have the same God, what a blessing that is. And so that's what she said. When Naomi saw, verse 18, that she was despised to go with her, was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her and threw up her hands and said, Okay, you have convinced me. Now the two of them went to Bethlehem. It happened when they came to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them, and the women says, is this Naomi? Is this that sweet lady that left? Is this Pleasant? That's her name. But she said, I'm not Naomi. I'm Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Her life is over. I'm Mara. You ever been there? I want you to hear this. Ruth is not where she thought she was. Ruth is not where she thought she was. Pardon me. Naomi is not where she thought she was. My life is over. It's going to be bitterness the rest of my life. And yet it is the God that had been so mean to Naomi that Ruth says, that's the God I want to embrace. And so when you read Naomi's word, you've got to understand this is not the God that she lived before Ruth. And so they get back there, they get back there into that land. And so they move back to Bethlehem, and then we make a point, and then we're going to spend the rest of the time. I've got, about 18 minutes chasing a rabbit, because there's something I want us to recognize that we may not have fully understood, and that is she had property when she got back. The land that she had was hers. She probably did not have it, if you understand, but she had a right to it. And by inheritance, that property was Ruth's. And we'll show this a little bit later in this book, and so you may think, you may have your eyebrows lifted. I don't know if that sure is that right. Just hang on. We're not going to get there today. It'll be next week before we get to that point. But I want us to head in a different direction for just a minute, because Jesus described the kingdom of God has within it a scribe who goes into his storehouse and brings out treasures both old and new. Scribes were those individuals, not necessarily inspired, but who had just read the Bible, Old Testament Bible, because their work was to make transcripts of the Bible, to scribble the Bible in a real positive sense. And that's why they were called scribes. And all their life, they read the Bible. I believe that word applies to preachers. I have no hesitancy at all in preaching first principles. No hesitancy. Why? Because in the treasure of a lifetime of study, there are things that are old. They're not leftovers. They're just as good now as they were the first time they were ever preached. You know the song. Those that know it best seem hungering and thirsting to hear it like the rest. I don't know if Tim is in here or not. Tim may be ushering right now, but Tim Cox said to me, "Dan, I love it when you and David preach first principle sermon. It just reconfirms my faith in the fact that what I'm doing is right." But that scribe tries to bring in some things people may have not have thought about. And I want us to, you may have thought about this, and you may be 10 years ahead in your study, and you may know where we're about to head. I want us to look at the government of the Jews in the land when they came to the promised land. When they entered into the promised land, there was a theocracy. What on earth is a theocracy? Let me put three words on the screen. Three words that if you can define these three words and the words of our monocracy, democracy, and theocracy, it may help you understand and have a better view of the Old Testament and how it functioned. And we have tried in America to make America a theocracy. I thank God for those words that are part of my heritage, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. But sometimes we try to bring into a democracy and turn it into a theocracy, and there is rebellion unbelievably. Let's go back and define these words. We don't put the words, don't put the answers up there yet. What is a monarchy? What does mono mean? You know what mono means? One. Chrissy, rule. Has anybody, just raise your hand if you've ever lived under a king. Well, there's one Brit here. There's a couple of Brits right up here, and that's it. There's another hand came up. What's that mean? The king rules. Now, you've got a real modified monocracy in England. I mean, you've got Parliament and everything, and so you got to remove Parliament away from understanding that. But in the ancient world, it was always King Nebuchadnezzar. And he did exactly what he wanted to do. He was the single ruler. Democracy, demos, is the word indicating people. A democracy is where the people rule. And the third one is theocracy, and theos is the word for God. Go ahead and put the definitions up there. I think that will help you see what we're talking about. Israel was a theocracy. What does that mean? It means that God ruled, and so when he gave the law, he gave not only religious laws, I'm talking about Israel, but he gave social laws. He gave laws that dealt with the very thing that government deals with today. And that is, whose fault is it when somebody's fence is down and a cow gets over and eats his neighbor's corn? Does the Bible discuss that? Not the New Testament. But the Old Testament gave that. What if somebody brought charges against an individual? And they're false charges. Well, we have government to take care of that. In the New Testament, in the Old Testament, there are many laws in the Old Testament. And so when you begin reading Leviticus, especially Leviticus, but you get over to Numbers and Deuteronomy, and then you see the application of it. The Old Testament law was both civil law and religious laws. Now then, if we can talk about that, and we're getting maybe ahead of ourselves, and if you look on the screen, I not only say God rules, but I put the word the God rule. If I talk about Mohammed in our culture, if I talk about Iran and Iraq and a Muslim world, it attempts to be a theocracy. And so inside the dictates of the Muslim world, and in some places, even in America, where there's a large Muslim population, some cities, there are courts that are set up, and they're ruled by the laws of Mohammed. It's not Jehovah God reigns, the gods reign. Now then, to go from that and to try to develop this a bit further, the Jews, when they came out of the land of Egypt, they had Moses to lead them. But when they got into the promised land, the land was divided with very strict boundaries. There are about three or four chapters, I believe it's in the book of Numbers, where before they ever get into the promised land, Moses says, now when you get the promised land, this is the land that is to be for Judah. It is from this point over to this point, and from this point over to this point. And the laws were given that set the boundaries for those tribes whenever they got over into the promised land. Now they get into the promised land, and what kind of government do they have? Well, they've got the Bible. They've got the priest to teach them the laws of God and to tell them all of these things. But sometimes there are questions that need to be decided, and so God raises up judges. I put the word judges in capital letters when I say he raised up judges to settle strife, because that's the name of one of the books in the Bible. And so sometimes there are laws that are stated, but how do you apply those laws? As long as Moses is alive, what do? They come to Moses. You remember when he's out there leading them into the promised land? You remember when his father-in-law comes and says, Moses, you're working too many hours. Why don't you select some lesser judges and let these lesser judges hear these matters, and you will only deal with the major matters? And that's exactly what happened. And so there was a type of government where at least under the time of Moses, there were these judges. But when they get into the promised land, look in Judges chapter 2. If you'll take to the book of Ruth and just turn back 10 pages or so, and you get to chapter 2 and you start reading in verse 10. They're in the promised land, and we're starting, I guess, in verse 8. Joshua, the servant of God, died when he was 110 years. Verse 10, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers and had another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done in Israel. And so the next verse says, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. You remember what Moses said to his own generation right before he died, Deuteronomy chapter 6? The commandments I have given you this day, you teach them diligently under your children. Now, he's not talking as he leaves Egypt. He's not talking at Mount Sinai. Moses is within 1 month of dying, and depending on what part of Deuteronomy you leave, maybe 1 week, if not just the day before he died. That's what Deuteronomy is. It's his last words. And so he says to that second generation, many of them, most of them, were born after they left the land of Egypt. And so here you've got 40 years have passed. You've got a brand new generation. And Moses says, when you get in that land, you'd better teach your children about the laws of God. What did he do? You teach them about the laws of God diligently. Theocratic law, as well as civil law, as well as religious law. When they studied it, they were to learn their own things. You know what? How the Bible describes them? Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. If you have a society that does not know about God, and the basis of that society is that the principles of God are to govern you, and I'm talking about the Old Testament situation, and you don't know the Bible, what are you going to do? Isn't that amazing? Every man set up his own standard. They turned to idols. Why? They had forgotten, thou shalt not make unto thyself any graven image. I find that interesting. Not nationally have a national image. You shall not make unto yourself, singular, a graven image. But if you don't know that, you want a God, you look at culture, there's my God out there. I'm going to take the gods of the Canaanites, these people in this land. And so you had a situation that developed. And so when that developed, the Lord allows, look down in verse 11, when they disobeyed God, verse 12, they forsook the Lord. And when they forsook the Lord, verse 12, and served Baal and Asheroth, the anger of the Lord was kindled against him, and he brought nations against them. Now, over in Deuteronomy, it says, I'll bring famines against you also. That's why we made that point about perhaps it was that very judgment that God that caused Elimelech to leave the land of Moab. And so now then, you've got these individuals over here. And as long as that judge lives, verse 16, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hands of those who plundered them. But they would not listen to their judge, but they played the harlot with other gods, and they turned quickly out of the way and went back, every man doing right in his own eyes. The Lord tried. He tried to get them back to listen to the laws of God. This is a theocracy. And every man was doing that which was right in his own eyes. And so, verse 18, the Lord raised up judges for them. The Lord was with that judge and delivered them out of the hands of the enemies all the days of that judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groanings because of those who had oppressed them and arrested them. But when the judge died, you know what happened. You know what happened. I want you to look in Judges chapter 8. You have to turn about 3 or 4 pages, get to Judges chapter 8. There is a judge by the name of Gideon, mighty, unbelievable person. And after Gideon had led and delivered the Jews against the Midianites, the men of Israel said to Gideon, Judges 8 verse 22, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson, for you have delivered us from the king. Gideon says, I will not rule over you, nor will my sons rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. I will not be your king. And the reason he gives, the very reason he gives is that you already have a king, and that king is God. The Lord will reign over you. Do you know what they're called in Exodus chapter 19? As they leave the land of Egypt, they're called a kingdom. They have a king when they leave the land of Egypt, King Jehovah. And whenever in 1 Samuel, they ask to give us a king, Samuel's upset, says, they've rejected me and my sons, judges. Samuel, the last judge, we've been rejected. Give us a king. And the Lord says, Samuel, they've not rejected you. They've rejected me that I should be a king over them. When they are under the period of judges, they're under a king. They are a kingdom. It's King Jehovah. How's he going to rule? Theocratic law. And they got outside of that. Moses described that king that they would choose in Deuteronomy chapter 17. And he says, whenever you get a king, that kingdom is to make his own handwritten copy of the Bible and read it every day. Are you reading through the New Testament? Now, they only had 8 books of the Bible, by the way. Whenever this was said, let that king make his own written copy of the Bible, handwritten copy, and let him read it every day. In Judges, and in 1 Samuel chapter 10, we'll stop just as soon as I read these verses. Starting in verse 8, whenever they said, we want to have a king that will reign over us. I said, it's chapter 8. I don't know how I've got 10:8. It must be 8:10. Yes, it's chapter 8, verse 10. The verses are wrong on the screen. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked for them, and he said, you want to know what your king's going to be like? You want to know what life under a king is like that ignores the commandments of God? He says, he will take your sons and daughters, for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots, and he will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, and will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest and to make the weapons of war and to equip them with chariots. He will take your sons or take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers, and he will take the best of your field. And then it says, he'll tax you, verse 15. And that's the path they chose. I think it is interesting, if you'll study, the framers of the Constitution of this land knew that a theocracy did not work. They just left England. But it is interesting how they tied declarations of independence and things of that nature to God. And one of those four founders of our family says, democracy will not work in America when America no longer believes in God. And we're in it. That's it. We'll take up right here next week and everything, but there's more that needs to be said, but just wanted to stretch your head a little bit.